We'll get started. Instead of grabbing your donut and shooting out the door. My privilege to introduce to you this morning B. Steve Huey and the Bees for Barry. He is the Director of Mission Interpretation Communication at Board for Mission Services of the Synod. He was born in North Carolina in 42, got his education at Bronxville, later went to Fort Wayne, graduated there in, 68. And after seminary, studied Spanish, Latin American culture in Cuernavaca, Cowshorn, Mexico, and was prepared by it for service in the Venezuelan field, where he served some 12 years in Caracas as director of the Christ for All Nations Spanish Lutheran Hour, and also responsible for mass media production. Took a call in 79. He was there 68 to 79. Took a call to El Paso in 79, where he had opportunity to be instrumental in the starting of two Hispanic missions, as well as Friends of the Border, a mission and relief organization. In October of 88, he came to St. Louis, assuming his duties as director of mission interpretation on the staff of the Board for Mission Services. And the unique thing about that job is that he, in his role, links the Board of Mission Services with the Board of Parish Services, with the Board of Stewardship Services, and is instrumental also in the support of team, developing support for together in mission. He's married to Grace Miller of Arnold, Missouri. They have three children. And would you please welcome B. Steve Huey. He'll be talking to us today on updating Asian missions especially. And here you go.
Good morning. It's good to be with you, and I understand this is a very special day for many of you as you get ready for call day. How many of you are expecting a call for Vicarage or your final call for the parish? Okay. Are you a little bit nervous about that? No? The interesting thing about this whole experience for us, my wife and I were commenting the other night, we have a number of students in our church who are going to be getting calls, and the difference between your day and ours is the fact that in our time we were nervous or a little bit excited about it, obviously, and just as some of you would be. But now, the children of the candidates are really anxious, and we have a couple of those children in our Sunday school classes, so we're really interested to see their reaction and how they respond to this whole experience. So we have a lot of new dynamics with that whole change in the student body. We're glad to be with you today and to be able to share with you a little bit about world missions in general, and I'll hope to give you some chance to ask questions or to respond to some of the comments I make. And I'd also like to draw your attention to some of the handouts that I put over on the table so that when you go out you might take some of those. One of them that I think is especially helpful to people who are going out for their first call or who are going out on Vicarage is an article I wrote for this coming Alive edition of the Lutheran Reporter. And it has to do with the role of a pastor as missionary. The pastor as mission leader in the congregation has a number of ways he can function in building a mission vision. And I just try to summarize those ideas. Things like you as a pastor will desire to lead in mission through your preaching and through your commitment as a teacher and counseling, and go through those various areas or roles that a pastor has and help you see how your mission work can go on as you do all of those various things. And then for all of the people who are here today, I'd like to draw your attention to a new resource that we've begun to produce now every month. It comes out about the 10th of the month. It's called Mission News from the Lord's Harvest Fields. It's a two-page newsletter that gives updates on the work of our church and the mission field around the world. And I think it's something that you can read on the run. We purposely did it that way, knowing how much people have to read today, but at the same time wanting to have more updates on what's happening. I also have some other resources about several of our newest mission fields, like Macau, which I'm going to share with you some slides, and Thailand, which is also a very exciting field. I was there recently in December of 1990, had an opportunity to visit Korea, Hong Kong, Macau, and Thailand. Very interesting and contrasting kinds of places. And I thought today I can't really tell you about each of those places, but I would like to focus later on Macau, which is a little bit unknown to many people, and perhaps you might be interested to know a little bit more about that place. I'd like to start, first of all, though, with a little overview of some of the greatest challenges I see right now in mission. And I'm going to use the overhead to do that. I'm listing up here a number of key mission challenges we're facing right now. Sorry, we're losing. I want to talk about then the key mission challenges. Businesses have a mission statement. Recently I was listening to one of the armed forces generals talking about the Middle East, and he described in very great detail the mission that they have in a particular part of Iraq. And you hear those kinds of statements quite often, so fairly soon people begin to think, well, what is the church's mission? And you begin to ask people in congregations, and you get really a lot of strange and unusual answers. Recently I was speaking in a church, and I was talking to a group of lay people, and they said their mission was their school. Now, you know, that's not wrong totally, but the fact is the school really needs to be seen as a means to accomplish God's mission, not an end in itself. And this was a church that has, unfortunately, an attitude that many others do in the church as well. Another problem, I think, is the fact that a lot of times mission becomes everything that the church does. So much so that mission then becomes nothing, if you follow my drift. People are basically saying, mission is every activity that the congregation does, and just summarize all of those, and that adds up to the whole mission of the church. Now, in one sense, you might be able to say that. If all of those things were helping to support the Great Commission, I guess I wouldn't have as much trouble with that definition. But the fact is, in many congregations, there are many activities going on which may or may not encourage the Great Commission, the reaching out to the lost, the helping of lost people to become reconciled to Jesus Christ. So those are some of the concerns we have in that whole area. If we had time, we could really deal with that in greater detail. So as we look at this whole issue of let me just give you an overhead here that might further clarify this. We're talking about mission. This is a more narrow understanding, which I feel more comfortable with myself. And as this chart illustrates, there are about 500 million people who have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. Now, this is a very difficult thing to measure, and it's yet just an assumption that we're making based on different research that has been done by people like Garrett and others. But let's say that there are 500 million people out of the 5.2 billion people who have that kind of committed relationship, people who understand that they are called by their baptism to be involved in mission. We also have another 1.2 billion people who consider themselves Christians because they're part of the Christian culture. And of course, we have, unfortunately, some people in our churches who are in that category. Then there is another large group. You could find people like this in Europe and parts of America, maybe. Non-Christians within the reach of Christians. There's about 1.4 billion of these. And then we have a large number of unreached people. At this time, about 12,000 people groups are unreached, people who have not yet heard the gospel. And these people are outside of the contact with people who are Christian. That's why we have to send missionaries to cross the cultural barriers in order to reach those large numbers of people. So there you can see a little bit of what we're talking about. Another look at this is shown on this overhead. Here we see the total population of the world on the left side. And you also can note the large number of urban versus rural people, about even right now, and the number of children, etc. And then over on the right-hand column, you see the unevangelized world, closed countries making up about 1.3 billion people, the evangelized non-Christian world, 2.1 billion, the Christian world. Well, what's interesting about the Christian world is it makes up about 33% of the global population, but it also has 62% of the global income. 80% of all telephones, 78% of all television sets, 88% of all computers, and it spends 99.9% of all Christian income on itself. So, you know, that's the real interesting point that we need to realize, that we're constantly spending most of the money the church is raising for its service and the work in the church for ourselves. And only 0.9% on the evangelized non-Christian world, leaving only 0.01% on the unevangelized world. That really puts it in perspective, and you begin to see how little effort really is being placed on reaching that unreached group of people in the world. So that's why I say we have a problem with our understanding of mission and what we really mean by that. One work on this particular topic is helping. This overhead comes from David Garrett, who's considered one of the experts in mission statistics. He does an update every year, and this is from his latest update. We have three parts to the world here. Part A refers to the non-reached part of the world. Part B are the people who are Christians, but Part B would be the people who are within reach of Christians. That is, people that you could witness to or who have someone around them who could share the gospel with them if they were open. And then the part C at the bottom of each of those circles represents the Christian world, those who already are Christian. Now, the interesting thing is to compare the timeline from 1491 to present time, 1991. In 1491, there were 418 million people. And there were 19% of the population of the world at that time, Christian, committed people, Christian at that time, as opposed to 33% in 1991. But notice what happens to circle B and circle A. In 1491, 79% of the world's population was unreached. At this time, there's 23% of the world's population which are unreached. So we are making progress. And yet there are millions of people being born each year, which continues to make the challenge yet still a real one. What's real interesting to look at, too, is at the bottom of this, some of the statistics are helpful. Again, the fundamental flaw in today's Christian world mission is that most mission agencies are not targeting the world A, which is the non-reached part of the world, 12,000 unreached people groups. They're targeting other Christians, so there's no contact and therefore no mission. Now here are some of the facts. 23% of the world, that part A, is ignorant of Christianity, Christ, and the gospel. 97% of all Christians are out of contact with non-Christians. 90% of all evangelism is not directed at non-Christians, but at Christians. 91% of all foreign missionaries is targeting populations in world C, that is, in the Christian world. 95% of all Christian activity benefits only world C. And then 99% of all Christian discussion and writing addresses only Christian interests. 99% of the Christian world's income is spent on itself. What we're basically saying is a lot of the material resources that we're
turning out in the church today is not directed to the lost people, but to those who already know the gospel. And that's not wrong that they need reach, but we also need to balance it just a little bit, as this shows. Going back to our outline for a moment, another key mission challenge is the lack of clarity about key mission objectives. We are trying to become clear in our own church body about the objectives, especially for the Board for Mission Services. We can't do everything. We're a small church in comparison to the challenge of the world, but we do have a clear understanding now of what we really want to focus on. We're going to focus on three basic things. One is helping to plant churches among the non-reached people groups of the world. That requires analysis, research, and understanding of the world situation. We also want to train national leaders, people who can continue to develop self-supporting and self-sustaining congregations of believers in their home countries, and thereby continue the church's work. And not only that, but that they would also become missionary churches, churches that are also sending missionaries into the world. Because many times countries in the third world have a better chance of reaching other people in the third world than perhaps people from the more developed countries. That's also their responsibility as Christians. And then after we've accomplished those two major goals, we would also say that nurturing the church through various means of Christian education, etc., are also important in order that it might be truly a missionary church. Those are basically our goals, and we are not against doing social ministry, but we also like to see it done with and in tandem with evangelism, and we feel that is a very biblical way to do it. So having clear objectives is very important. The problem is we haven't always explained these objectives to people. We haven't helped our church body focus on our clear objectives in foreign missions and mission here in the States. A third area is the growing ethnic ministry opportunity in North America. We indeed do have a growing opportunity, as I'm sure all of you are aware. Tremendous numbers of Hispanics and others. Let me just show you. Let's have a little quiz here. Don't get too nervous. But right here before call day, I heard that you don't get too many tough quizzes. But just to keep your minds alert, we won't do the whole quiz, but let's just see if we can pick out a few that relate to our own situation. Let's try number 7. The city of Phoenix, Arizona is growing faster than the country of India, China, Kenya, or Bangladesh, which has the highest birth rate in the world. What would your answer to that one be? Any idea? Actually, it's Kenya. Kenya has the highest birth rate in the world right now, but the city of Phoenix, Arizona is growing faster. What a tremendous opportunity our church has if we could be on the ground floor of all that population growth that's taking place in Sun City, or some people call it Sin City. Anyway, there's a tremendous chance to do that in some of these growing cities of America. How about number 8? Guadalajara, Tijuana, or Los Angeles is the second largest Mexican city in the world after Mexico City. Yes, Los Angeles. They have over 2 million Mexicans in that city, and it's a very interesting statistic. Let's try, this one is helpful, number 13. An important demographic trend in Canada is the decreasing percentage of citizens of European heritage from 70.7% in 1971 to what percent in 1981? Around 50%. So by the year 2000, over 50% of the people in Canada will be of foreign birth. Now that has a tremendous implication for Canadian Christians, and some of the same kinds of things are happening here in America. It's not quite as drastic because we have a bigger population to begin with, but when you only have around 26 million people, and you have a tremendous number of new people moving in, it doesn't take too many years to change the demographics radically. So our church is made up of a lot of older people in Canada, and yet they're going to be receiving all the new people from around the world and they're needing to look at their mission opportunity. Those are just a few statistics then that help us see the real challenge that we have today in ethnic ministry in North America. A fourth point that I'm listing here is the great disparity regarding mission commitment by congregations. What do we mean by that comment? We're really trying to say is that there is a tremendous difference between the various congregations of our church body. We have some churches that are absolutely on fire for reaching out to the lost, cross-culturally, evangelism, social ministry, all of that together is happening in some of our parishes in exciting ways. And we have others that, frankly, are absolutely asleep. I've become very concerned about this because it affects how we do our mission education work. For a long time, I was operating with the idea that our mission education objective was to equip our congregations for mission with resources and whatever else. More and more, I've become aware that we need to make our objective that of awakening a mission vision, because if you're asleep, you can't be equipped. And frankly, that's where we are in the case of many of our congregations. How would you do that? How would you awaken a mission vision when a church is truly asleep in regards to the urgency that's needed to reach out to the lost, to people who don't know Christ? Well, I think one answer that we've begun to explore is evaluation. Assisting congregations through objective evaluation means to see where they are in terms of God's mission. Let me show you what I'd like to share with the whole church as we have an opportunity. This is a 10-point mission commitment scale. For you who are going out in the parish, I hope this will be helpful to you to think about. This is, again, not a dogmatic kind of thing. It's just meant as a tool, a subjective tool at that, but it can be helpful. What we try to do here is, starting at point one, see how far up the scale we can find our congregation. Think about the church to which you relate most closely right now, or the parish to which you're going to receive a call. Would you say that your church is at this time at point number one, unaware or unconcerned about God's mission, making followers for Christ? Is there an initial awareness, perhaps? Is there a tolerance or acceptance of the idea? Let's go up a little bit higher. What about priority? Is there a church in the group here represented in the sixth category? The congregation is doing all it can to make world evangelization its top priority. What would you say? Your church at that point, do you think? Now, what do we mean when we talk about a mobilized church? This is a term that we really feel is a very helpful one to talk about the kind of churches we really need to have in the future if we're going to be a church that's living the gospel and sharing our faith in a real way. I'd like to suggest some possible standards by which that can be measured, because otherwise we aren't sure what we're talking about. Up here we're listing under mobilized 10% of the members regularly sharing their faith, 10% of the members praying regularly for world evangelization. Does that happen in your congregation? Do you think it should? What about the other point, 10% of the congregation's total receipts are directed to cross-cultural missions? We have congregations that are giving even higher percentages to outside the congregation purposes. But when you really look at how much of that percentage is for cross-cultural outreach, the percentage is much lower. 1% of the congregational members are deployed as cross-cultural missionaries. Wouldn't that be exciting if every congregation had a missionary serving either in the U.S. or outside of this culture? And we have a couple of congregations who actually do have 3 or 5 or even 10 missionaries that they are supporting from their own midst, sending them out in mission. And that's an exciting development which we hope to be a part of. You had a question?
Will you talk about that more later as far as what a mobilized congregation might look like and some of the dynamics of that?
If we have time, I'd like to come back to it, but I'd better move along to get through the rest of the outline. But it's a good question. We're working on some diagnostic tools that we can help congregations work through these kinds of things in greater detail and help them in turn look at themselves. We don't want to tell them, this is how we see you, but we want them to say, this is how we see ourselves. That's the only way you can really do it. But let's say you got up to point 10. That would be the greatest level of commitment. There we describe it as a passion for God's mission. That's what we live for. God's mission is the passion of all the people of God, not just the pastor or the mission leader or the evangelist leader, but it's the whole church loving the world for Christ's sake. That would be an exciting thing. Our goal in the next couple of years is to identify and help equip 2% of the percentage congregations that would be mobilized. In other words, to try to identify mobilized congregations in every region and district, and then hold these models up to the rest of the congregation and say, this is what it looks like. Now let's see if others can get the vision. Now you notice a mobilized church is followed by number 9. I forgot to mention that because that's rather interesting. A mobilizing church is one that is already mobilized but is now assisting another church to become mobilized. And that's the missionary spirit, and that's our idea. Because we've read and heard, and I'm sure you maybe have heard this as well, that if 2% of a group of people are committed to a real important task or ideal, that group of people can change the whole mass. And that we feel that this must be true of congregations too. So we're not going to set this wild goal of having 4,000 congregations by 1995 that would be mobilized, because frankly that's not where we are right now. But if we could have 2% by the end of this decade, then we could begin to talk about becoming a mobilized church over the next decade and a half. That's what we'd like to see happen. Increased involvement in global mission by congregations and individuals. This is an exciting development that we're really beginning to see. More and more, we have lay people coming to us begging for opportunities to serve in cross-cultural mission work. And frankly, we're not quite ready for it. It's a very embarrassing situation. On the one hand, I go out and others do, talking about the importance of being involved in mission. That's the best way to really talk about it, not just be educated, but actually do it, you know. And then people say, well, I'm ready to go. Where can I go? And what we're having to do, and thankfully I think we have the openness for this, is to work as partners with congregations. Recently we assisted a congregation in Columbus, Indiana to be involved in a sermon event with adults from the congregations. Their second trip to Guatemala, 10 members of the congregation went to Guatemala, spent a couple of weeks. They sent several of their team ahead of time to do all the legwork so it wouldn't be such a hard mission for our missionary there, who's very loaded down with other things too. And as a result, this group of people came back to the congregation with new vision, excitement, and a lot of neat things are beginning to happen in that congregation now too. That's the way we have to operate, allowing more freedom, but also being willing to be partners with congregations. We're finding out that the so-called mega churches, the larger churches in the Senate, want to be partners. They don't want us to give them canned programs. This is the way you have to do it. But they're really willing to sit down with us and explore, you know, programs that can be very helpful to their situation. And that's what we're really trying to do. The need for cross-cultural training for church workers and laity, number 6, is a very key challenge for us. This is something that this seminary and other seminaries are dealing with today, need to deal with more, I think, because every pastor in the future is going to have to deal to one extent or another with cross-cultural issues. It may be on a small level with, you know, a 10% of your members who are from another cultural group. But to the extent that you understand and can relate to people of other cultures, you not only will be enriched yourself, but others will be able to receive a more effective ministry with you and through you. So those are some things we'd like to see happen, and not just for pastors, but lay people. In the church I served in El Paso before I came to San Luis, we had a large number of our lay people involved in cross-cultural ministry through teaching of Sunday school classes, things of that nature, in the Hispanic community. And these people grew significantly through this kind of contact. That's what we need to help and encourage. Number 7, the changing mission scene, partnership, missionary role, teamwork. The whole idea here is that no longer can we have a paternalistic approach to missions. We have done that in the past, and we repent of that, we need to repent of it, but now we need to operate as partners. We need to recognize that more and more our mission work will be done through contact and work with partner churches, for example. One of the ones I'm going to share with you today is the partnership we will be developing with the Brazil Lutheran Church in a place like Macau, which is on the other side of the world, near Hong Kong. Now, why would that happen? Well, it's because Macau is a Portuguese colony for over 500 years. It has its legal system in Portuguese, even though most of the people are Chinese today. It would be a great benefit to have people who have a Portuguese understanding and background. That church is desirous of being involved in world missions. Why not encourage their missionaries to go and assist them as well in that task, instead of sending always people from our own country, especially when we don't have enough missionaries for all the areas that we need to fill at this time. So partnership is a key challenge. Mission funding, I want to say a few words about that issue. Mission funding is a growing challenge for the church. We can't do the work of the church without the basics of faith in Christ, commitment, a sense of urgency. Those are more important than money, really. But finally, it does cost something financially to run a worldwide mission operation. The travel for our staff is operating right now at about $600,000 a year. Some people think that's a lot of money. But when you add up all the missionaries and the other staff that have to travel because that's part of their job, it really isn't a terribly out-of-line number, we feel, and we're not ashamed to tell you what the number is. It's just what it costs to do the job of getting where you're going. But nevertheless, mission funding is a growing question. Why is that? It's because less money is finally getting to the synod and district level. We're getting less than 1% then, finally, for missions, for the Board for Mission Services work, of the funds that are given to congregations. That means that we really can't expand unless we find other ways to fund the mission. Now, various things have been done in the last year to help encourage this. One of the things that has happened is the formation of the Mission Resource Unit of the Stewardship Department, working very closely with our Board for Mission Services. I'm the liaison with that organization, with the Mission Resource Unit. Right now it's made up of 4 key individuals who are involved with such strategies for funding as letters that are sent to donors on a regular basis. We have a new Mission Sowers Club, which is just starting. If any of you want to be charter members, these are people who give from $25 to $1,000 a month to help support the mission efforts. Already, after only 3 weeks, we have $10,000 in that fund and a growing number of people who are willing to be involved. So we do have some approaches to this. One of the new ideas is what is called the expanding the circle concept, where you give congregations the opportunity to sponsor a mission project, and they are in turn informed about that project and kept in touch with the missionaries and others who are involved with that project. And we feel that this is a very responsive kind of way to do it. Now, why is this happening? It's happening because we are dealing now with a baby boomer population and mentality. And one of the characteristics of this group of people is they want choices. They want to have something to say about how their funds are used. They request their involvement that way. And so what we're having to do is to say, this is what we are doing with your money. We're telling you how we used it. We have to be responsive. Now, I really believe that this is a good development. Why? Because it's forcing the Board for Mission Services and our whole church body to be accountable. And in the final analysis, if we're not accountable, we're not going to be able to accomplish effectively the Lord's mission. We need to be accountable to each other as Christians in the body of Christ. We shouldn't be afraid of that, and the only people who are afraid of it are people who want to build kingdoms for themselves. But if we're building God's kingdom, we can be accountable to each other. that's really part of what we're talking about then with mission funding. The role of mission education, I'll have to skip over that today because if I got started, that's the area I'm most concerned about. I'd probably speak too long, and I don't want to do that. But just let it be said that mission education is an area of ministry that needs to be emphasized not only at the synodical level, but in every congregational synod. Any of you have an idea about how many of our districts have an active, functioning mission education committee? This will reveal the challenge that I'm facing in my work and the church is going to face if we don't deal with some of these realities. What would you think? Are you 39 districts or so? We only have three that actually have a functioning district mission education committee. And it would probably not be an exaggeration to say that we have fewer than 100 congregations that actually have a functioning mission education committee in the congregation. That's a strange thing when you think about it. If we say mission is a very high priority of the church, and we say education is a high priority of the church, we're trying to equip people and inspire people, inform people about the mission of the church. Why aren't we structured to do it? These are some of the issues we're trying to deal with and will be dealing with in the years to come. One of the things we're doing is using models like South Wisconsin, which is a very beautiful model of a district that's really committed to mission education, and sharing this model with other districts. But congregations need to get involved also. And I can hear some of them groaning already saying, what, another committee? And some churches are too small to have a committee. Maybe they need just one person. But for sure they need the pastor involved and his commitment to that whole area of ministry. Then we have the rapidly changing world. The rapidly changing world can best be shown on some statistical charts I have here. This is one that I think is really interesting. It's not real easy to see, but note here the growth of the world population itself. Back at, let's just see here, we're at 1000 BC here, less than a billion people. The first billion didn't come along until after 1800. And now we have 5.2 billion. So what's happened here is you see the chart, it just goes off the end here. It just exponentially increases like that because more and more people are having more and more children and longevity, etc. So what are we dealing with? A really dynamic, changing situation. The world's population is truly growing. But at the same time, the growth is not just an even sort of thing. We're not just spreading all these people around equally and on the planet. It's really an urbanization thing. This is the key mission issue today, urbanization. And our church is really basically a rural church. At least our mentality is rural. And we're going to have to develop an urban strategy. We're going to have to send urban mission teams to do mission in the cities. And frankly, that's the toughest mission you can do. It's much harder than working in the bush. From my own experience, I can tell you it's tough when you have to deal with traffic and all the other issues that you have in these major cities like Bangkok. 30,000 new cars are added to the streets of Bangkok every week. I mean, that's an incredible statistic. Think about that. And our missionaries are literally about to go crazy with that issue alone. That's a tremendous, tremendous challenge if you're trying to do work. This map here shows the percentage of population living in urban areas. The darker colors represent the 100% urban areas, and you can see kind of where the rural areas are by the more light shades. So just look at that for a minute. You can see the percentages quite well. Mega cities, what an interesting statistic here. If you look at the world, in 1985 there were 256 mega cities, that is a city with a million people. And by the year 2000, we're expecting to have 408 cities of over a million. Interesting thing, in 1990 there were 27 cities of 5 million. And by the year 2000, there will be 58, or double the number, with 5 million people. So huge cities are starting to develop around the world. What's going to happen down the road? You can see 2025, we're looking at 639 cities of a million people or more. Where do you see these larger numbers? Interestingly enough, in the less developed world, let's compare those. In 1985, in the more developed world, there were 110 megacities, and in the year 2000, there will be 129. The less developed, well, that's interesting, from 110 to 279. So that's where the cities are growing the most, in Latin America, Africa, and Asia. This is not a surprise to you, but I think the magnitude is definitely something to reckon with. This chart gives the list of cities around the world by rank, and of course, Mexico City is the one that in 1990 had 21 million, and by 2000 it will have, now the new statistic they're updating, is perhaps as many as 30 million. I mean, that is an incredible number, because that's like twice the size of some of the Latin American countries. Venezuela has 18 million, I believe. So you can see there, one city has more than the whole country of Venezuela. Pretty incredible. And then this chart, I think, is quite helpful to just see where all this is in perspective. The world's neediest people live within a band, 2,000-mile band, across from West Africa, across Asia. Within this area are 62 countries with a total population of 3.1 billion. 97% of the world's least evangelized populations live in this band. So if you're wondering where the countries are that we need to focus our mission attention, that's where it is. You can easily remember it by this chart. And only 27% of the missionaries in the world work among these people. So that percentage needs to increase also. The emergence of the global church is perhaps one of the biggest changes that we're going to be dealing with in our time. This is truly something that we aren't always aware of. The Western church is not the only church that's working. In fact, some of the churches like the Korean church are extremely active in outreach. This chart shows the number of Christians who are emerging in various parts of the world. For example, in Africa, in 1900, there were only 1.7% of the population Christian in that country. And in the year 2000, we're expecting 16.6% of the world's Christians to be in Africa, 324 million. That's an astounding increase. So you can see that the African church is truly a viable mission-sending agency, or church, for this purpose. And an interesting thing to compare here, in the year 2000, would be the number of percentages from Europe and North America. From 63% in 1900 to 31% in 2000. So in 100 years, that percentage has drastically changed. And that's the new reality we're going to be dealing with. That's why we have to work as partners with African and Asian churches, because they truly have a large percentage of the Christian population and a zeal that sometimes we need to emulate. I wanted to talk about Asia today, and I better do that before we run out of time. I just want to show you the map that really helps capture it for me, and I hope for you. You see that box over part of Asia there? That represents, by the year 2000, two-thirds of the world's population. That's really a tremendous thing to think about, because, you know, I don't know exactly how much space that takes, but let's say it's an eighth of the world's space, or a tenth, and yet half of the population, or two-thirds of the population of the world will be in that box. So truly that is a tremendous mission area for us to consider. And of course, a big part of that is China, which is an area that our church is really looking at more and more today through the China Coordinating Center, the work of Lutherhauer, and various things that we're beginning to do there. Population of 1 billion. religions. You can see Christianity is a very difficult thing to define. Between 5 and 50 million is the statistic I keep running into, and I'm thinking, that's really a weird way to put it. 5 and 50, there's a big difference. But the truth is, we really don't know how many Christians are involved in the house church movement. We can only count the ones who are in the free self church, which is the more defined government-related church body. So how do you know? At the same time, we know there's a growing church in China because we have people who go there and who are working there at this time. I'd like to shift the focus now for a moment to some slides about the work in one of the places near China, Macau. Macau was a Portuguese colony. Okay, it means we've got 10 minutes or so, right? And it has been developed there from Portugal for about 500 years. Our church has worked there off and on for 25 years, but has never really developed a very dynamic church. It has been done through the Hong Kong church. And now we're starting our own outreach in Macau as a separate mission through the work of Dr. Jasper, who happens to be a pastor and has several doctorates, especially in the area of special education. He has developed the only existing school of its type in the whole country of Macau, which has over 500,000 people. He was able to get the trust of the government, and they provide something like 70% of the funds for this work that he's doing. Based on the trust that he's developed with the parents of these children who for the first time are getting an education. These are people who are developmentally handicapped, sometimes retarded. He has been able to gain tremendous respect, and now the people themselves are coming to him and asking that he would start a church. So this man is working by himself right now. We want to get more help, other workers, and as I mentioned earlier, the Brazil church will hopefully help make that happen in the near future. Let me get to the slide projector. Can somebody get the lights over there? Dr. Jasper lives in Hong Kong at this time. He plans to move to Macau, but he has to take a two-hour trip to Macau by boat and various other transportation. It's an interesting trip as you start out from Hong Kong itself, shown in this picture, over the waterways to the neighboring colony of Macau, which is a peninsula and several islands off the coast of China. Macau has always been a little bit of a stepchild for China, and also for Portugal, for that matter. It has always been a place for adventure people, pirates and others used to hang out in Macau. And it still has a little bit of a rough and tumble kind of atmosphere, in that gambling is its biggest industry today. On the ship, you can see on the way over the variety of people who live and work or go to Macau is quite phenomenal, from all around the world, truly an international setting. Again, gambling might be part of the reason for that, as people go there for sport or whatever. Here we see a part of downtown Macau, which is quite different from Hong Kong being one of the most modern cities in the world. Macau is such an interesting blend of the Mediterranean architecture. The Portuguese have left their mark on the country. And you can see on the left the words in Portuguese, on the right Chinese, so you see that interesting mix all the time. Here's a street scene, typical of Macau, a lot of poor people, certainly a lot poorer than its richer neighbor, Hong Kong. Building in the background is quite interesting because it shows how they do their construction. They build these bamboo constructions outside of the building, and they're able to paint the building or to do repairs or whatever standing on that bamboo scaffolding. But there are certain families that learn how to do this, and they actually have quite a good business with those scaffoldings. But as I say, Macau is a very poor place. Here you see a very poor lady walking along one of the streets. Some of the middle class housing here, you don't have a lot of room, so you have to hang your clothes out the window. And this is a very typical scene of Macau. I found the people quite happy in Macau. Actually, the appearance of the people was much more low-key or happy than we found in Hong Kong, which is more frenetic pace. Some of the newer buildings are going up, and this particular building is supposed to have, when it's completed, 5,000 people just in one building. They tend to have smaller spaces for housing and more people in less space, so it really makes for quite a compact situation. This picture shows a variety of architecture, the Portuguese building in the front, which is now a school, and in the back we see a more modern high-rise. Some of the signs are still in Portuguese. You see there Avenida, the avenue of the particular explorer, whose name is on that. And an interesting phenomenon I discovered as I walked around Macau, very much like Latin America in appearance and feel, little parks settling all over the place, and yet there was a strange thing about the parks, except for the one man in this particular park. This was apparently a female park. And next door there was another park, which was apparently the men's park, and I could only surmise that maybe some of these people were married, but they split up when they went to the park. But typically that's, I was told, how they do it. The men tend to socialize and the women socialize in their different sections. And children playing in the other end of the park there in one of the areas. That's a Buddhist temple behind in the background. About 95% of the people in Macau are Chinese, and so that becomes the predominant ethnic group, and of course Buddhism is one of the widely practiced religions. Many of the people do their shopping on the street, as in this scene. Here we see some of the faces of the people, very Chinese look to them. And this picture here is quite interesting for me, because I wanted to show you the setting in which the Concordia School is located, Dr. Jasper's school. It's in the building to the right on the first two floors of that building. But it's in a very crowded area with a lot of businesses, and including industries that are spewing out waste on the street, kids playing everywhere. It's just a very strange place. Here's a neighborhood right next to that building, just so you get a feel for the setting. One of the little cafes across the street from that building. And here's a neighborhood that will eventually be raised and a new building will be placed in its place. But they kind of have a little shack area built in this area. This is a new building right behind the one where the school is located. And Dr. Jasper's dream is to expand his school into that neighboring building to reach some of the many new people that will be coming in. Here he is in front of that construction, and he was explaining his dream for expanding the school. They're pretty well limited by the space they have now. The school serves about 50 students. Here's Dr. Jasper with his secretary, Grace. Dr. Jasper looks a little frail because he is. It turns out that he has had at least 7 operations, major operations for cancer. He's very weak, but he continues to make these regular trips from Hong Kong to Macau, and he spends 3 or 4 days a week in Macau running the school. Thankfully, he has a very good staff of people who are working with him. This man is truly a real man of God and also a very smart man. He is able to translate from Chinese to English and at the same time sign in either Chinese or English, which I find a very interesting thing. You're dealing with 3 languages at least when you do that. And, you know, just a phenomenal gift that he has, speaking to some of the deaf students that he has now taught to speak with sign. Just a tremendous person and a very beautiful thing he's done here. Just as an example to show you what he's accomplished, he's brought in computers, he's helped the young people learn new skills they've never had before. In this culture, most of these people were kept in the homes and they were not allowed to go outside. So the people were ashamed that the public had known they had a child that was not totally 100%, let's say, capable. And so they would keep them at home, and they never had a chance to be educated. Dr. Jasper is changing this, and he's truly a pioneer in being able to accomplish this. Here you see some of the students with their teacher. They're having some games here. He's teaching them some of the signs that they need to learn to communicate, so he makes a game out of it. One of the neat things that Dr. Jasper is doing is teaching the Chinese people themselves how to run a school. So he is not too worried that if God calls him home or he has to leave the area that the thing would not continue. That's an important thing. But he's really concerned that before 1999, which is the year that China will take over Macau, a church be planted so that at least the basic group of believers would be functioning prior to that time in case the government would not allow free worship. Here you see a very practical approach in the school is to teach the young people how to take care of the buildings themselves. One of these young people in the picture, the second one from the right, is an example of a very interesting part of the story. This is a young man, about 18 years of age, who had never been to school in his life. The parents thought he was severely retarded. He had never been taught to even speak. And now Dr. Jasper has him working in the school, not only learning, but taking care of some of the maintenance. When I was there, he was changing all the filters in the air conditioners, which I just thought was a tremendous example of what can happen because of one man's vision. And again, we see a couple of faces of people remembering the challenge that God has given the church everywhere to reach out to lost people. Most of the people in Macau do not know Christ, and truly there is a tremendous opportunity for our church if we could begin to see the vision that Dr. Jasper has and do our part to assist him. I have to tell you, I got real excited about Macau because it was such an interesting mixture of Hispanic or Mediterranean and Asian for me, but also because I could see the need, and I really felt almost like I'd like to stay back there and work with Dr. Jasper. And I hope that some of you would have that same feeling as you see the opportunities, just tremendous opportunities. Kind of a couple of coincidences. The street on which the school is located is actually called Concordia Street. That comes, I guess, out of Portuguese. But it's called Concordia School, which is very appropriate for one of our schools. And just a tremendous opportunity now to start a church in that very location. Okay, any questions in our waning minutes that we have here? Yes?
Is your decision to minister or to reach out in Macau through the Brazilian church connected because Dr. Jasper is part of the Brazilian church?
No, he is not. He is one of our missionaries. He's been in Hong Kong working for a long time. He helped found and develop the Hong Kong School for the Deaf, which has since been taken over by our Hong Kong Synod. And since that work is fairly far along and they are not in need of his services any longer, he was like a good missionary looking out to where he could start something new. And so he took his specialization working with handicapped people to Macau, which had absolutely not a single program, and was able to start this really neat school, which will have the basis of hopefully the new church. Yes.
Could you tell us in 5 minutes what's happening in Thailand and what the strategy is and the like? Korea, we hear quite a bit about from
sure.
Dr. G, but...
Yes, I have thought about sharing about Thailand. I knew I couldn't talk about every mission or even a couple. Thailand is a bigger field, so it's more difficult to explain in a short time. I'd just like to sort of share the emotion of it, if I could, since we have time for all the details. But Thailand is one of our newest fields, having begun this a few years ago. What's exciting to me about it is how obviously the Holy Spirit has put together the mission team in Thailand. I visited Thailand recently, and I was very, very aware in all my visits with the missionaries that truly God has put this team of people together. Why do I say that? First of all, because a number of those missionaries had gone to Thailand on their own, with their own support, and had developed outreach to lost people. One of them has been working among the Karen refugees, Dennis Danal, who's from Hong Kong International School. Having worked among the very elite in Hong Kong, he began to venture out and see other opportunities. And when he visited the Karen, he realized these people need help. So he was willing to go and work, and was working there for a number of years with support of some Lutheran churches here in the state's congregation. And a few years ago, our Board of Mission Services offered the opportunity of him being a part of our board. And then a couple of other people were also in similar situations. Bill Timmons from Taiwan, one of our former missionaries to Taiwan, had gone to Bangkok with a different agency and was doing social ministry. And he was also then linked up with this same team. Another young lady by the name of Vanderheide began to help teach English to the Karen people. And she also wanted to go back to Thailand on her own. And then the Gernon family, stayed-born and Herb Gernon, she was a Thai citizen and married Herb Gernon, who had been, at one time he went to the seminary for a year, I believe, and the family went back to Thailand in about 1988, I think it was, and were able to begin some mission work in the area around the southern part of Thailand, in an area which is really quite Buddhist and with very few congregations or churches. In fact, I met one person in that part of Thailand who had been baptized 20 years ago by an itinerant evangelist from England. And when this itinerant evangelist returned to England, this individual didn't have a church to which he could relate, but he kept reading his Bible. And he just kept trusting that God would eventually send a missionary and help build a church there. So for 20 years, he prayed and read his Bible, and believe it or not, then at the right time, God sent the Hernan family, and they in turn took up the challenge of working with him and others to build a church. And that is a very exciting area of the country because there are a number of new congregations springing up in some of the surrounding villages. But it's really a tough ministry because it requires time to travel to these various places. Translation work is going on by State Corn Gernon. And of course, I think you know the son of State Corn, who's a student here at the seminary, and Ted Matalan, who will be involved there as well. So it's just a tremendous thing to think about how God is pulling together key mission people and building a team of people who truly have a vision for God's mission. I think we're going to be real excited about that particular mission, for sure. Thanks for letting me be with you today. I think there's a lot more we could say, and if you're interested in some private questions, some of you probably have to go, so you're free to do that. But I'd be happy to talk privately with any of you, and I think I'll be staying for lunch, so if some of you would like to eat lunch together, that'd be fine also.